This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 90 years ago this summer, the assassination of an Austrian Archduke set off a chain of events that changed the world forever. The armies that marched bravely across Western Europe that August would vanish into a cauldron of mud, barbed wire, and blood. Millions died before it was over. Three empires were dismembered by defeat and revolution, and the victors emerged with very little to justify their horrific losses. The tragedy of World War I utterly transformed the way we thought of ourselves. The perfectibility of man, the steady progress of civil society, science and technology as intrinsically good forces, all casualties of the Western Front, along with faith in military and political and religious institutions, faith in the old order. As we look for lessons 90 years on, we can't forget that they are drawn from the collective experiences of millions of individuals. This is a recollection of a German infantry soldier recorded by London's Imperial War Museum many years afterwards.
One day we got orders to storm a French position. We got in, and my comrades fell right and left of me, but then I was confronted by a French corporal, he with his bayonet at the ready, and I with my bayonet at the ready. For a moment, I felt the fear of death. I was quicker than he was. I tossed his rifle away, and I ran my bayonet through his chest. He fell, put his hand on the place where I had hit him, and then I thrust again. Blood came out of his mouth, and he died. I nearly vomited. My knees were shaking, and they asked me, "What's the matter with you?" I remembered then that we were told that the good soldier kills without thinking of his adversary as a human being. The very moment he sees him, a fellow man, he is not a good soldier anymore.
What was it about? Was it worth it? How did it change the world and the way we think about the world? Later in the program, picking up lives changed by Hurricane Charlie, but first, the lessons and legacy of the First World War. If you have questions about how it started, why, and what lessons there are to be derived from it, give us a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now by phone from Wellfleet, Massachusetts, it's Adam Gopnik, a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, who addressed many of these questions in a review of a recent batch of books about the Great War in this week's issue of The New Yorker. Adam, good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Pleasure to be here, Neil.
What is it that you think is giving rise to this, beyond the 90th anniversary, in looking back to the First World War?
Well, I think there are two separate and almost paradoxically contradictory things that are at work here, Neil. First one is that among professional historians, professional military historians in particular, for the first time, 90 years is long enough ago to make the Great War history. And we can begin to treat it, that is, they can begin to treat it, the experts can begin to treat it now, the way you treat anything else that happened in history, without the emotion that you summoned up so eloquently at the beginning of this program, without the sense that it was necessarily a cataclysm before anything else, an explosion in the march of human progress that in some ways ended the optimistic civilization of the 19th century. You can begin to look at it as just something that happened without that, some think, undue emotion. And I think that's a lot of what's happening with the expert historians. For those of us who are non-experts, who are simply readers hungry for history, I think, have a much closer relationship to it, oddly enough. That is, we read it because we want to understand how it was that an immensely peaceful, prosperous, and successful, hopeful civilization managed to commit suicide. And we are conscious of the fact that we live in a moment now when a similar level of peace and prosperity was achieved, has been achieved, and it seems to us to be in many ways threatened, and we want to see if we can spot some significant pattern of mistakes that led that civilization to commit effective suicide and can prevent us from doing the same thing.
And you look at, as long as we're mentioning paradoxes, the diverse lessons that are drawn by many people from the starts of the First and Second World Wars.
Yes, I think that's one of the deep ironic facts about the history of what we now must call the last century. That is that you can choose which war it is you think is a model of human behavior. If you believe, as so many people do, that everything is like 1939, then the lesson you learn is that you have to confront your adversaries before they have a chance to do their worst, that you should never give in to a bully, that you should never appease, to use that important word. But if you look at the lessons of the First World War, of course, they're almost the opposite. That is, what the onset of the First World War teaches you is that you should go to great lengths to try and find some compromise before you plunge into a war on the basis of some kind of imaginary honor, that you should never honor treaties and alliances before you honor the common sense of avoiding massacres, that you should do, the First World War teaches you that you should never rush into a fight, and the Second World War teaches you that you should never give in to a bully. And those two lessons are very contradictory in a very practical way. You know, John Kennedy, in the midst of the Cuban Missile Crisis, had Barbara Tuchman's book, The Guns of August, about the onset of the First World War by his bedside, I gather. But at the same time, of course, his generals were all saying, this could be another Munich. We mustn't give in to Soviet blackmail and so on.
Well,
he had to decide which one was the appropriate model, the pattern to apply to the history he was faced with.
Let's now talk with one of the historians whose book is reviewed in Adam Gopnik's piece in the New Yorker magazine. This is David Stevenson. His book is Cataclysm, the First World War as Political Tragedy, and he joins us from the BBC studios in London. And thanks very much for agreeing to talk with us this evening.
It's a pleasure.
One of the things that Adam writes, and your book also discusses it as well, one of the images that we have of the start of the First World War is that beginning with the assassination of the Archduke Ferdinand, there was almost a clockwork mechanism of mobilization, that as each state issued ultimatums back and forth, once the armies started to mobilize, there was this clockwork mechanism that prevented anyone from stopping it.
Yeah, I think that's a view which was put in the 1960s by historians like A.J.P. Taylor and in Britain, and they wrote partly with the possibility of a nuclear exchange in mind, and they were very much trying to put across the view that wars can come without necessarily being desired by anybody. But a lot of the new research on what happened in 1914, I think, very much undermines that view, and Adam Gopnik has picked that up in his New Yorker review of the literature. What I think the correct metaphor is not so much railway trains, but actually like a big manoeuvre by someone trying to do a kind of dangerous overtaking manoeuvre on a highway, pulling out and seeing a heavy truck coming in the opposite direction, and nonetheless putting their foot down on the gas pedal and keeping on forward. In other words, what I'd say is that governments in 1914 do what they know are risky things, that they pursue and accept consciously a risk of war, and are willing to go through and fight a war rather than back down, even when they realize that the crisis is moving in a dangerous direction.
Partly because their view of war was didn't encompass anything like what they turned out they were getting into.
I think that's true as far as the politicians are concerned. I mean, it's a kind of cliched view that politicians expected the war to be over by Christmas, and a lot of European public opinion thought the same thing, that they expected it would be a bloody war, something like the Franco-Prussian War of 1870, which had high levels of casualties, but they thought it would be fairly short and fairly decisive. What we now know is that a lot of the professional military advisers in Europe actually expected it to be a long war, going on for at least 18 months or 2 years or more. But they didn't actually convey to the political chiefs their full misgivings about what it was going to be like.
Adam Gopnik, it's almost inconceivable in our modern era, but as you point out, this was a time when there were no conferences, nobody gamed this out, nobody said, hey, wait a minute.
Well, that's certainly one of the impressions I came away with strongly from reading the recent literature, is that I know that the historian John Keegan makes much of this in his history of the First World War, that there were no moments when everyone came together within one nation, that is the military and political leadership together, and said, what is going to happen? What's our best position here? That though there was no inevitable, inexorable, clockwork-like movement happening, there was no and Professor Stevenson may see this differently, there was no decisive single moment when each country decided to go to war, that it was more, as he says, more like trying to pass somebody on the highway and you find yourself in a head-on collision before you quite understand what's happening.
We want our listeners involved in the conversation. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And why don't we begin with Neil? Neil's calling from San Francisco.
Yeah, about 5 years ago I was in Sarajevo and I saw the spot where the Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated, and it's a picturesque little spot on the river in the heart of town, and of course that is one reason why we took the whole Bosnian affair in the 90s so seriously, because it was an incubator of great troubles for Europe and we didn't want to repeat that, and I think that has to be reminded to people today, that the Balkans have been a source of a lot of problems. And
I have to say, when I was in Sarajevo many years ago, you could still step in the footsteps of Princip, the assassin. They
that's
were
right,
left in concrete.
Princip, yeah. I'd like to emphasize, too, that not just the Western Front, but the Eastern Front, the Balkans, the Italian Front, and the Middle East, Iraq and Palestine, they were, and of course the open ocean, were all scenes of great slaughter and loss of life. Here's another aspect. There was a series of little wars from the mid 1890s up to the Balkan Wars of 1912 and 13 that kind of prepared the world without knowing it for this bigger war, and the Russo-Jap and the Spanish-American War among them, and they kind of lulled people into the idea that wars could be short. Mm-hmm. And then here's still another thought. The fact that the collapse of the Russian Empire brought about communism, which in turn brought about fascism and Hitler's Nazism, and also the collapse of the Ottoman Empire brought about the problems that we still have in the Middle East today with Israel and the Palestinians and everything. All of these things are connected. So all of our problems right up to the present have really been arisen heavily out of World War One.
David Stevenson, particularly a response to obviously Neil's point that the while we all remember the Western Front, a lot was going on in many other parts of the world.
Yeah, well, I agree with that. If you look at the Eastern Front, fought mainly in Poland between Russia on the one hand, Germany and Austria-Hungary on the other. There are as many soldiers involved in that as on the Western Front, but because they're drawn out all over twice the geographical length of the Western Front, there wasn't the kind of density of force to space, so it was a somewhat more mobile front. But there were heavy casualties there. And also, as rightly said, the Italian Front, which is hardly known about now, but Italy and Austria-Hungary fight a three-year battle in the Alps and Dolomites in many ways, in even worse conditions than in the Western Front, with hundreds of thousands of casualties on each side. The Western Front is the sort of image that haunts us still, I think, down to the present day in the West, but it's not the only front by any manner of means, and actually the majority of casualties in the war happened elsewhere.
And go ahead, Adam.
No, I was just going to say, actually, oddly enough, of course, it's absolutely true that the Italian Front is forgotten. Yet, in an odd way, that's the front that entered the American literary imagination, because that's the front that Hemingway was on, and the front from which Farewell to Arms emerges. I do think, and maybe this is the difference between the way an historian and a writer looks at it, that the concentration, the imaginative concentration on the Western Front, though it's absolutely true that as an historical fact, it's disproportionate. I wonder if, as a kind of imaginative insight, it is inappropriate. That is, that there's something about the Western Front, something about the concentration, the scale of the slaughter, the utter futility of the action that appropriately haunts us, that rightly seems to us in memory to have a kind of singularity, a kind of horror.
When we come back from a short break, Winston Groom will join us. He's written a book about the Western Front in the First World War. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation, NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. At the start of the First World War, 90 years ago, all sides, as we've heard, assumed it would be over fairly quickly. But within the first few months, a bloody stalemate set in along a double line of trenches that stretched from the Swiss border to the North Sea. British soldier Frank Johnson was near the northern end of those trenches in Flanders on Christmas Day, 1914.
We stuck a board up, Merry Christmas. They also stuck one up, Merry Christmas. So we were saying, well, I don't think they'll fire today. No, I don't think they will. Then lo and behold, here was a German coming down the river bank with his hands up above. One of our chaps threw his equipment off. He went out to meet him. Well, they shook hands. Then we all got out. Company commander come rushing in. He was going to shoot any man that went over. Some voice from the next bay said, you were too damn late. He didn't know who it was, so said it. So we all had to get out. Well, we mucked in all day, talking one thing and another. One of the Germans said to me, and in excellent English too, well, he said, I don't know, he said, how long do you think this damn war is going to last? I'm fed up to the neck. Well, he said, you were not the only one fed up. I said, we're up to our necks in water and mud. He said, we're the same.
Frank Johnson recorded his recollections for the BBC. What was the Great War about? Was it worth it? And how has it changed our world and the way we think? We want to hear from you. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Our guests are Adam Gopnik, a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, who wrote reviews of a number of books about World War I in this week's issue of the magazine. Also with us is David Stevenson, the author of one of those books reviewed. It's Cataclysm, the First World War as Political Tragedy. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Matthew, who joins us from Silverton, Oregon.
Hi, Neil. I'm interested in a particular aspect of how we learn from the past, and that's that in some sense those lessons only last as long as the lifetime of the longest-lived participants. In the example of World War One, for 65 or 70 years, it seemed that the nations of the Earth always, you know, searching for more effective and more powerful weapons were actually really were forsaking the powerful weapon of poison gas. And then about the same time those soldiers passed from society, we started seeing it again in Iraq, Iran, in the subways of Japan. And I'm wondering if your guests can comment on whether there really is a qualitative difference in how we remember history when that passes from personal experience to actual written history.
David Stevenson, I wondered if you had thoughts on that.
I think it's First World War isn't as remote as the Crimean War or the Napoleonic War or the French and Indian Wars in the 1700s. It's just at the sort of margins of lived experience, because I can remember my grandfather, who served right through it and was twice wounded. And many of the other people who've written these new studies that have come out in the last 5 years similarly remember their grandfathers. So there is still a kind of personal link. It's not as dead or as remote from us as some of the wars that further back in the past, although it is true, as Adam was saying at the beginning, that we can take a longer perspective from it. On the question of the lessons that you can learn, that the trouble is, and I think Adam again sort of hinted at this at the beginning, it's such a huge and complex and controversial event that you can learn lots of different lessons from it. And in a curious sort of way, I think each kind of succeeding generation has taken different lessons from World War One. The image of it that we have now as a kind of futile war that achieves nothing is something that becomes widespread in the West really in the 1930s, when it became clear that it looked as if there's going to be another world war. But in the 1920s, the generation that actually fought through it thought it had been a terrible experience and very costly, but they didn't say it had been futile. That idea comes later, once it becomes clear it hasn't been a war that's going to abolish war after all.
Matthew, thank you.
Thank you.
We mentioned earlier, I think Adam Gopnik mentioned, that the Western Front remains the focus of people's imaginations of what the First World War was like. Winston Groom, the writer best known for Forrest Gump, wrote about the bloody four-year battle in Belgium in his book A Storm in Flanders, and he joins us now from his home in Point Clear, Alabama. Good of you to join us today.
Thank you, Neil.
You're a novelist by trade. You've written other historical narratives. But what intrigued you about particularly the First World War and the bloody fights around Ypres in Passchendaele?
Well, when I was young, probably 13 or 14 years old, I used to have Sunday luncheons at my grandparents' house, and my grandfather had fought in the First World War with an American division and had gone back in the early 1920s and visited all the tours of the Western Front and brought back a series of Michelin travel guides, which the Michelin Tire Company put out, I assume, to have people drive around in cars and burn up more tire rubber. And one of these was entitled The Battle for Ypres. And I would look through it as a young teenager and was just stunned by the photographs in this travel guide of the devastation of that town. It looked like the atomic bomb had been dropped on it. And ever since I had, through all these years, developed an interest in that, wondering, especially after my own experience in Vietnam, how on earth could they get people, get soldiers to endure that for 4 years, four long, bloody years. And so finally, after I wrote Forrest Gump, that set me free to do what I really like to do, which is write histories. Hmm. And so that's what I did.
One of the theories, as I'm sure you well know, Winston Groom, is that the generals who were in command of the battles, caricatures of generals staying in chateaus well behind the lines, stocked with fine wines and good food, sent the men out to slaughter without the thought of what was going to happen to them. I think you take a different view.
Well, to some degree, the image of the chateau generals is correct. But also, statistically, I believe there were 61 British generals killed in that war. They weren't killed in their chateaus. The blame mostly falls on General Sir Douglas Haig, who took over in 1916, because he pursued the strategy of simply driving the Germans out of Belgian soil and French soil. And it was a long and bloody slog. And I'm not trying to challenge history here or revisionist history or anybody else, but when I looked at it in its entirety, one conclusion was inescapable, which is that in the end, Haig and the British and the French won the war. And I don't see how else they could have done it. I mean, they couldn't just not do anything.
David Stevenson, is history kinder to Douglas Haig than our general recollections of him as I think the number of stereotypes you could use of him as a butcher are legion.
There's still a debate about Haig, and they may well always be. The trend in the literature over the last 10, 15 years has been to rehabilitate Haig, I guess, and certainly to rehabilitate British generalship in a larger way, partly because of the points I think that your guest has just been making, that in the end the Allies do emerge on the winning side, though, and the British Army does improve its performance. It's clearly fighting much more effectively by 1918 than it had been by 1916, and develops a kind of combination of technology, tanks, aircraft, particularly also very effective use of artillery, which the Germans can't resist. So they do get better, and Haig bears some of the responsibility for that, or at least doesn't obstruct it. And they are on a kind of learning curve, though it's a terribly costly learning curve. The other side of this, though, I think it's still clear that the German army also makes major mistakes, especially in 1918 when they come out onto the offensive themselves and take a million casualties in a matter of months between March and July 1918. And if the German army had not done that but had stayed on the defensive, then the war would have carried on much longer, I think, even though one can see the British and actually also French armies as becoming more effective.
Winston Groom, what lessons do you derive from the World War I in general and that 4 years of bloody fighting in Passchendaele, Ypres in particular?
Well, I think the lesson that would be most pertinent is what General Pershing, the American general, the commander in chief, said when the American troops began to arrive by the hundreds of thousands. And the fighting then, as David had said, is by this time the basically a slaughter of Germans who were trying to break out and finish off the Allies before the Americans could arrive in force. And Pershing objected very much to the notion of an armistice. What he wanted to do was pursue this attack and march the entire German army back into Germany with their hands raised in the air so that the German people would believe that they had actually been defeated. In fact, they did not believe that, because the German army walked back into Germany and claimed that they had been betrayed by crooked politicians and the Jewish people and so on. And this, I believe, led to the rise of Hitler and his gang.
Winston Groom, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Winston Groom, the author of A Storm in Flanders, the Ypres Salient 1914-1918, Tragedy and Triumph on the Western Front. David Stevenson and Adam Gopnik, I wanted to ask you also about an aspect of the war and its legacy, and that's its effect on our cultural lives. David Stevenson, how did the world look differently to artists in, say, the summer of 1914 than it did in by the winter of 1918?
I think it depends which artists you're looking at. In some ways, what's another thing that's come clear from the new research is that the war isn't as much a cultural break as used to be thought. In particular, the kind of links between the war and what's called modernism in the arts are not very sharp, as there's a lot of evidence that the big trends like Picasso's cubism in painting, Stravinsky's Rite of Spring in music, new developments in literature, these things are actually happening before 1914. And when the war breaks out, it actually encourages conservatism in the arts rather than making people even more radical. You can see Picasso, for example, starts painting in a more realistic way because he thought it was more patriotic to do so in France by 1915. The war actually causes a kind of conservative reaction in some ways against the avant-garde. And the real sort of dramatic shift to modernism in the arts comes in the 1930s, not during the war. And another, just one final point on this. The way in which the war is remembered, one of the reasons why Wilfred Owen and so on and the war poets are so effective is because they're not very experimental in technique. They actually use tried and trusted rhythms and metaphors and sound imagery and so on. And in that way, they can actually communicate to a mass audience much more effectively than if they tried to do what the modern artists were doing.
Adam Gopnik, we're talking with him, a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, and David Stevenson, the author of Cataclysm, A History of the First World War. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Adam, one of the poets you quote in your story in this week's New Yorker, a very unexpected poem from Rudyard Kipling. "If any question why we died," he wrote, "tell them because our fathers lied."
Well, it's a simple couplet that Kipling wrote after the death of his son. Kipling had a very complicated and relationship to the war from the 1914 on. And, of course, one of the things that makes the war so pitiable in the old-fashioned sense is that it was so ideologically Catholic in its slaughter. Oscar Wilde's son Cyril died on the Western Front, and so did Rudyard Kipling's son John. I think that when it comes to the question of how the war is remembered and how it affected Western culture, it's certainly true that any kind of crude notion that that the world was all Tennyson and Gilbert and Sullivan up till 1914 and then became T.S. Eliot afterwards is absurd. But I do think that there is, nonetheless, I would argue, a kind of very profound rupture. You know, if you look just at the history, as David was saying a moment ago, of the visual arts, of some Picasso, the spirit of Cubism before 1914 is essentially, it's entirely experimental, avant-garde, but it's essentially optimistic. Its attitude towards technology, for instance, Picasso and Braque both identified passionately with the Wright brothers, with Orville and Wilbur, with the notion that our future is in the air, with an essentially benevolent and shining vision of what technology could bring, and that what modernity could bring to modern art. And that vision, I think, was disrupted for good by those 4 years for modern artists. It's modernism coalesces and goes on, but that particular quality of modernism, which we find in Cubism or in the painting of Robert Delaunay or someone, that kind of rhapsodic belief in the future, I think is eradicated from our civilization at that moment and only barely recovers, 100 years later.
Now let's get another call in. Rob is with us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Years ago when I was in the service, I actually traveled around some of the battlefields, and I stood in a place called the Menin Gate, and I was once told that that was the single most deadly spot on the Western Front. I don't know if that was true or not, but it was sort of an eerie feeling. But the point I wanted to make was that I teach some classes on it, and one of the things I've always said is that I think this generation that is growing up now in high school in many ways is the first generation that is growing up in a world that is not directly affected by the long-term effect of the First World War on the geopolitical situation, certainly in Europe. And I'd just like some of your guests to maybe just address that point.
David Stevenson?
I'll hang up to listen.
Thanks, Rob.
In many ways, I think that's important, your guest said, in Europe. You can see a kind of continuous chain of reaction and counter-reaction from 1914 through to 1991. It's become a kind of commonplace among historians to say that World War I leads to World War II and World War II leads to the Cold War, the division of Europe, and so on, via the fact that the First World War causes the Russian Revolution, Bolshevik takeover in 1917. Now, I don't think any of those things are inevitable results of World War I, but the fact is, without World War I happening, it's difficult to see that other chain of disasters as resulting. So there is a kind of situation, I think, after 1991, in some ways the curtain has come down in Europe at one level. At another level, one of your people ringing in has already mentioned Bosnia and the breakup of Yugoslavia in the 1990s. The fact of the matter is that World War One leaves a kind of number of legacies in the peace settlement of sort of unexploded bombs, which don't detonate until very much later. Yugoslavia, creation of Yugoslavia is one example. That's a product of World War One. Creation of the Czechoslovakia, which also breaks up in the 1990s, though fortunately peacefully. Outside Europe, the boundaries of Lebanon were created after the First World War, which helped to create a situation of potential civil war in that country. Rwanda is a product of the First World War. Northern Ireland is a product of the First World War. So, of course, is Iraq. Iraq was not a kind of political, single political entity until the 1920s.
David Stevenson, thank you very much for your time today. David Stevenson is the author of Cataclysm, The First World War as Political Tragedy. He's also a professor at the London School of Economics. Also, our thanks to Adam Gopnik of The New Yorker. More after a break. This is NPR News.